Welcome to Take the Red Pill,
where we explore the realities within our reality.
We are your hosts, Donald
and David. Greetings, everyone, and I want to welcome back after a long hiatus. Thanks for your patience in our little downtime here, but it was worth it because we get to welcome Donald back to the great state of Washington. Donald, it's awesome having you back.
Oh, thank you very much, David. I love being back in my home state.
Yeah, it's just the feeling of home, right?
Yeah, I grew up in Alabama, but Washington, it grew on me over the past decade, so this is by far definitely home now, so...
Well, I asked Washington, and Washington's glad to have you back, too. Washington said, we didn't really feel quite right until while Donald was in Virginia. So.
I have nothing against Virginia. I got to a point where I enjoyed Virginia, and I actually have a little bit of separation anxiety from Virginia, but Washington is my home by far.
Well, I know that you made some really valuable connections there and that you met some great people and that you've just gained some really, really cool experiences. So it sounded like it was invaluable, if anything.
Totally, totally. So what's our topic this week, David?
Our topic is sex and spirituality. This is actually one that came out of the suggestion bin from our new forum that we have set up here.
Oh, cool.
It wasn't really too far of a hop because this came from my wife, so it wasn't necessarily a cheeky thing. I mean, because she and I have had conversations about it before. Who better to have this with than your spouse?
Oh, yeah.
You know, that there's a lot of, you know, spirituality that is incorporated with sexuality. So, you know, so I want to throw it your way, Donald. Tell me kind of your thoughts on that whole genre, that whole idea.
Well, I think a lot of people, you know, kind of get a little blushed or whatever when they start talking about sex, especially here in the West, because we that's just how we are, you know, how we're raised most of the time. And then you add spirituality. And for me personally, the way I've always felt out and seen where things were, it's like there's spirituality and then there's sexuality. And very rarely do you actually put them together unless, of course, you're working with Tantra and stuff like that. I think a lot of people are missing an amazing combination when you actually do put those two thoughts and ideas and energies together, because how is life created? How do we procreate? How do we continue our species? How we do it through sex. And then you add a spiritual component to it. It makes it even more than just physical. It makes it more of an enlightening thing. Mm-hmm. So how about you?
Well, I think it's interesting what you're talking about as far as the physical not being just the limits of sex itself. And I like what you say about, you know, the fact that there's so much more as far as the origin of our own lives being springing from sex. Because I believe that everything is symbolic in life. Everything is a symbol.
Mm-hmm.
And sex is very symbolic of the closest we can get physically within our physical confines of the flesh boundary to becoming a single entity, becoming a single person. And then the byproduct of that is someone who is a combination of the essence of two people, the actual genetic DNA material of two people. So I think there's a great symbology in the joining of it. And I think that anybody who's had a very rich and fulfilling sexual experience will tell you that the boundaries just become dissolved in moments and heights of ecstasy, and that you really can't find a separation between you and your partner in those moments.
Oh, yeah. And it's fun.
And it's fun, exactly.
Can't leave out the fun part.
You know, you're absolutely right about that. You really can't leave that out, because it's one of the gifts, I think, as physical beings that we get. That, you know, without a body, you know, there's so many simple pleasures that we take for granted. But, you know, the thing about it is with sex and pleasure, it's food, you know, we don't seem to, you know, we don't hide that under a blanket. Mm-hmm. We don't hide other things that are fun and that are exciting, you know, seeing colors and art and listening to music and all those things. We don't hide those under blankets, under covers, but mm-hmm. yet we do with sexuality. What's your thoughts on kind of why sex has become can be taboo and can be so controversial?
I think it's just the power of it. There is enormous power in anything that has to do with sexuality. I remember, I think I was in my sociology class in college, and I remember reading or hearing about, you know, women who go around topless to, you know, picket, instead of using a picket signs in other cultures, they would say, look, we're upset, we're not going to take this, we're going to freak out the guys. And it works really, really well in sexually repressed cultures. Going with more of legend, I think, was it Guinevere that rode a white horse through a town topless and whatever? So I think what it is
Godiva.
Yeah, oh, Godiva.
Lady Godiva, that's right. I couldn't remember.
So I think anything that has to do with sexuality is extremely powerful. And I hope I don't offend many people here, but a lot of religions kind of downplay it as well.
Why do you suppose that is?
Because it is so powerful. If you do not feel guilty about taking hold of all of your power, not just your mental and emotional power, but your physical power as well, you become so confident, and you can become so aware of who you are and know who you are and know your identity so well that anything that comes to the contrary of what you believe or where your interests lie doesn't really have a chance. If you're a big church or a big religion or, you know, any other kind of philosophy, or even politics does that too, that is trying to start up and get a lot of members and have control and do all this other stuff, then repressing sexuality is the first thing you do.
So here's what I understand you're saying is, if you can repress sexuality, something so innate in us, something that's such a heavy driving force that has so much power, as you put it, if you can suppress that, then people look for something else, for a surrogate, for a proxy for that sexual release or that sexual attainment.
I think your chronology is a little different. I'm looking at it more of, you know, you get into a philosophy, and then that philosophy can possibly downgrade and talk about the sin of sex and whatnot. If you follow the teachings of your philosophy, then you'll start believe that, and you start losing a huge chunk of your power. It's not so much of, oh, you don't have sex anymore. Oh, well, what else can I do? Hey, go and look at this philosophy over here and pay attention to that. I don't think it goes that way. I think it's the other way around.
So, in other words, if you say that something that we are, that is part of us innately, our sexuality, if you take that and you make it sinful and debased, you can kind of lesser a person's view on who they are and what they are. And so what they do is you say, well, let me offer you salvation through this religious doctrine or this ideology. Am I more on target there?
Oh, yeah. It's basically, you know, when you go into boot camp for the military, if you're a guy, the first thing they do, you know, they cut off your hair, buzz cut. Mm-hmm. Why did they do that? Because your hair is a symbol of who you were, is a symbol of who you're, of your civilian life. It's part of your identity. They basically make, you know, everyone the same. All right, you're all bald. You are a name, a number, and you're now part of this group we call the military. Sexuality in certain philosophies and religions and whatnot is exactly the same thing. If you repress the sexuality of your members, of the people that adhere to your philosophy or your religion, they're much easier to control. There's more of a feeling of, I am part of a group now. Mm-hmm. And that's very important, to feel like you belong somewhere and feel like you're part of a group.
Kind of like that cult who opted for castration.
Yes. Oh,
what was that called?
The Hale-Bopp. The Hale-Bopp Comet.
Yes.
I can't remember their name exactly, but I know which one you're talking about.
What were they called? I know it was that. Yeah, the comet was coming, and they said, "Well, you know what? I'm not going to need these when I hitch a ride on this comet, so I'm going to let go of this." And I don't know. It's like you're giving me a choice between, you know, this salvation and my sexuality. It's kind of easy for me, I'm going to have to say.
Well, it's like you want to go back into the whole David Koresh thing in the Waco, Texas, and how all that happened, or any cult leader for that matter. You know, it's very easy for a charismatic person who uses a standard that people are used to, such as religion or politics, to quote-unquote brainwash people, to manipulate them to get them to be your quote-unquote followers.
Right.
If you're in a group, say, like the Hale-Bopp group, and I wish I could remember their name at the moment.
They're nothing like the Skinny Bop group, which was the, what band was that? Oh, Skinny Bop Bop.
Yeah.
Poison?
I think that was Poison.
It was probably Poison, yeah. They were all about the sexuality.
Oh.
Quite the opposite.
She's my cherry pie, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But, yeah, if you get into a group and let's say this group was around for, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30 years or so, you've been in it for a year or more, you have a pretty good allegiance to that group. You're in that belief system so much that that is where you are and that's what you'll do. Back in the 70s, the Jones...
Jim Jones.
Jim Jones, that's right.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, we're drinking Kool-Aid. You know, and it's just like, wait a second, like, that, we're, okay.
Yeah, and they did use sex as control, each of those cult leaders. I mean, they did pretty much just kind of have liberty and license to take any partner they wanted, then restrict all the other members and control and determine who got to be with whom. So, yeah, I think that's another element of the control like you're talking about here.
I like that, the complete opposite. Instead of repressing it, basically using it as, okay, we have rules. I'm the leader. I choose who sleeps with who and who does what and with who, and that's just the way it is.
You know, and you got to imagine, too, with these cult leaders, when they take, let's say, these particular types of cults, and they take these women, and there's probably cases where they took men, and then you're engaging in the sexual acts with there, then you've got that euphoria and that ecstasy, and that kind of lends to creating that sense of connection and control by the parties that are, let's use the word victim just for like a better word.
Oh, yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Well, yeah. I mean, they've done study after study after study where you can train a mouse to hit a certain button in a cage, and every time he hits that button, he gets a treat or gets something that hits the pleasure centers of his brain, and then you take it away, he'll still hit that button for a long, long time afterwards, even if he's getting nothing.
Right, exactly, exactly.
So, yeah, I totally can see how you get the endorphins going through your body that make in your brain, making you feel good, and over time, over and over again, especially with a group of people that you create a community with, it can become very easy to get wrapped up in a leader's or a cult leader's ideas. And then, of course, you know, what they say, absolute power corrupts absolutely. So.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, when you're talking about the endorphins right here, it's sex is good. It feels good. It's very pleasurable. So do you suppose that maybe because it's such a driving force and it can be such to the point that we kind of lose sense of ourselves, or we can lose control or make irrational decisions just to attain something that feels so good? Like, for example, if you're a mouse hitting that bar until your, you know, little paws get blistered and you're still not getting the treat, but you want it so badly, you're just not making logical decisions,
mm-hmm.
because we all know mice do. But,
oh, Mickey Mouse!
The Mickey Mouse was not a logical decision. I kid, I jest. I know, like, people love Disney, but...
I love Disney, too, so...
But, you know, Disney and sex, probably not in the best conversation.
Yeah, I think we'll leave that one...
we'll do the Disney topic or something.
Oh, yeah, we'll leave that for later.
Yeah.
Or not at all, I don't know. There's enough going on with the conspiracies with Disney and sex.
Yeah, no kidding. But do you think that maybe... because it's such a driving force that can make us supersede our own self-control, do you suppose that there are and is room for social mores, that there does need to be restrictions and limits and taboos placed on it? I mean, do you think it's critical outside of religion?
To doing that goes against free will and free choice to me, mm-hmm. and that's kind of one of the big things that I don't like to be told I can't do something, as a lot of people don't like to be told that they can't do something. For public safety, it's good to have, you know, informative, you know, teaching classes and stuff like that. But at the same time, if somebody wants to live a lifestyle that's more dangerous along those lines, I think they should have the full right to do so. It's kind of like with alcohol. If you want to drink on a Sunday, then you should be able to drink on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you should not be able to drink on a Sunday, get sloshed, and then go driving on the road and endanger other people.
Right.
To answer your question, as long as it's not endangering other people and it's consensual between two adults, I have a hard time actually saying it should be regulated to a large degree or whatever.
Well, but then again, I'm getting into areas that are laws. What I'm talking about, I'm not talking about somebody's sexual orientation or preference. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous to legislate that, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah.
It just really is. And I'm going to put it out there, and I'm not going to apologize for it. That's
me neither.
My view. But at the same time, we do have legislation that puts statutory ages on, you know, what is appropriate consensually. I think we touched on that briefly. There's also, you know, people who don't have discretion as far as whether there is consent involved. There are people who participate in really negative acts, like, for example, you know, using medication to knock somebody out, and then they're completely unconscious of what's going on. You know, this is what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the legislation.
I thought you were talking more along the lines of two people want to get together, and for whatever reason, they're not allowed to, or they shouldn't be, because there are still some laws in certain states and certain counties that say, you know, if you have five people in a room and, you know, everyone has their shoes and socks off, it's considered an orgy by legal terms. And it's just like, okay. The thing is, if you drug somebody to have sex with them without their knowing it, that's illegal.
Right.
And so that would fall in the legal area of it. I was referring specifically to, you know, two people that say, hey, you know, okay, I like
no, that. No, but this is what I'm talking about is that when there becomes a drive that is so great, and now we probably need to take this conversation into where the social mores are actually springing from and where the distortions are springing from.
Okay.
For example, you know, if two people are of the same gender, go for it. You know, if you're attracted to each other, that to me, it's like, then nothing else matters, you know, just be together. And I think that's fantastic and wonderful. You know what? That's people's own business.
Mm-hmm.
But when there's a distortion, what I'm talking about is when somebody has a drive that is insatiable, and that drive is so insatiable that you can put as many laws up as you want, but people still will go out of their way. Like that show they had on television with Chris Hansen with To Catch a Predator.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and these people know what they're doing is illegal, and actually they know what they're doing is wrong. But at the same time, it's their desires are so insatiable. The laws and the moral ethics that are in place are not enough to deter them. And so this is what I'm asking is that what's this springing from? Why is there this level of deviancy that exists where we can't, where we no longer have self-control? Because there's a lot of people who have sexual desires and still have self-control.
Mm-hmm.
But there are people who don't.
For me, looking at it from an energetic perspective, I look at it as anything, any society or group or family or whatever that has a very strong sexually repressed tradition, people will react in various ways, such as every so often, these people that become deviants. I agree totally, there should be laws against that. Taking it from sexual area to more of a violence area, I saw a report years and years ago where basically the amount of murders by handguns in the U.S. was like thousands and thousands and thousands per year. Mm-hmm. And then they compared that to like Canada and Japan and all these other places that are industrialized, you know, fairly much at the same level. And there would be like less than 100 here and maybe 100 there.
Like we talked about in the last podcast.
Oh,
Yeah. I remember you talking about this, yeah.
We talked about that in the last podcast.
You mentioned it. It's a really cool thing. You know what? I'm going to look for that because I've seen that same thing, Donald. And you talked about it last time and you mentioned it this time. And I really think it's worth having in the show notes. So thanks for reminding me on that.
My brain has been so full of traveling the past since the last time we recorded. I really don't remember saying that. But
I know.
But yeah, I think that goes along the same lines with we have a very violent society where violence is totally accepted. And you can watch TV and see hundreds of acts of violence a night. just in prime time, you don't have any sexuality there. So the sexuality is repressed and the violence is totally expressed. I think that lends to a lot to having occasional people with psychologies that would be considered abnormal or, you know, deviant.
Well, there's a couple of things I want to talk about with what you're saying here. The first thing is about the violence.
Mm-hmm.
And what I find interesting is you talked about repression, which I think is a huge and critical component of this. When we're suppressed, and going back to the beginning of the conversation,
uh-huh.
You said that a lot of times the sexual repression is a result of a power base or a means to secure power.
Mm-hmm.
So if you make sexuality debase and you make it sinful and wrong and it becomes suppressed, then we identify with ourselves very sexually. We're sexual creatures and we identify with our sexuality. I don't mean just, you know, what our orientation is and, you know, our preference for what gender.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just talking about our expression sexuality. And if we cannot express ourselves sexually, then the violence is this kind of, this wells up and just kind of mutates into violence. And when you express it with anger, your value of the self is already debased. So you might as well just do something debased, and you might as well pick what is the most sinful of all, you know. The other part of it I wanted to mention too was we talked about repression. What exactly would we consider repression?
I think repression is anything that is a part of you that is part of your, that gives you a sense of power, a sense of confidence, a sense of, you know, identity that you disregard, that you try to shove away, that you try to ignore. Whether it be sexuality or ability, some people are really good at talking, some people are really good at doing, you know, high-level mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
If your power is able to do, like, rocket scientist-level math, then imagine repressing that and hang around people that are telling you all the time in media, in books, in, you know, family traditions, that what you're doing is wrong and bad and you shouldn't be doing it. We look at that and say, well, math isn't wrong. Like, well, neither is sexuality. But yet mathematics, it led to destruction or the atomic bomb and nuclear explosions that have killed millions of people, you know, over the past 100 years. So some people would say, yeah, but that was just science learning how, and like, but some people would consider that wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I am curious, though, bringing it back to the whole, you know, sexual, spiritual type stuff. I think it goes really good with, if you're going to be a spiritual person, a lot of people want to evolve and grow as much spiritually as they can, have that sexual, spiritual experience, because spirituality, for a lot of people, releases a similar kind of endorphins that sexuality does. I think that might be one of the reasons why it's easier to be taken off into a spiritual cult leader type stuff, because there is that very similar endorphin that is released in the body that at the same time that is released when you're having sex.
Are you talking about like an ecstasy, ecstatic, altered state of consciousness?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and that is one way to do it with spirituality in your belief system and your philosophies. A lot of power bases, a lot of control cult leaders and whatnot say, hey, transfer your sexual desires and interest into other activities. You know, you don't have to do sex because that's not great. Come to this meeting or do this thing or, you know, go out and help. And it's like, okay, that's all good and everything. But if you're going out and doing that just so that you won't be tempted to do anything sexual with yourself or anyone else, then that's totally giving your power away to your philosophy. And I think that's where a lot of the spirituality clashes with the sexuality. Of course, there are practices that positively combine the two, such as Tantra. With Tantra, a lot of people kind of sit there and like, oh, that's sex. I'm like, it's a lot more than just sex. It's spiritual connecting with people on a completely different level. And, you know, like what you said earlier, being as close that you can physically be to somebody, where you become one through the sexual act. You know, Tantra takes it a little bit further and, you know, says, okay, let's harmonize our emotions, let's harmonize our breathing, let's harmonize our thoughts, let's harmonize our chakras, auras, all that other stuff, work that way.
Right.
And
yeah.
And that, I think, is one of those spiritual practices that combines sexuality where the focus is not to get off as as a finality, but to stay in that moment of ecstasy as much as possible.
It's not about the checkered flag,
I think
what you're saying.
It's not about the finish line. It's about the journey.
Yeah, unless you're thinking about Danica Patrick, and that's a whole different
But I'm not going to admit I know who that is. Yes, I am. No,
yes,
I'm not.
But I do know what you're saying, and that's probably the best definition I can think of describing Tantra and tantric sex. I like the idea behind tantric sex. Sometimes I think you can get so much into the ritual of the what you're trying to do with tantric sex. I think that more so you can naturally achieve that without necessarily going through all the techniques, as it were, if you just completely open yourself up. And this is the amazing thing about sexuality with spirituality. Is spirituality in and of itself is, to me, one of the most intimate things in the world. No two people have the same spirituality. Spirituality to me is your experience of life beyond what you can put into words. And to really get so connected with somebody else's spirituality on a sexual level, sex is so intimate because you're very vulnerable, because you're opening yourself up. You're opening your spirit up completely. And I think when you're becoming tantric, it's the tools and techniques are ways of trying to enable and allow you to be open to the other person's energies, like what you described about wavelengths and chakras and rhythms and such. I think that helps to kind of pull down those boundaries that we tend to bring into ourselves. And I think the best sexual experiences of anybody I've spoken to are the ones where they say, you know what, it's when I'm most vulnerable, it's when I have my barriers down the most, when I am the most open, then you're getting as close as you can to really blurring those divisions of selves, of separate entities.
And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying you have to have you have to go through the practice of Tantra to have really amazing spiritual sexual experience. You know, just like you said, that's one way to do that, but I agree completely. The more open that you are with your partner, the better it's going to be, because being that open, like you said, the more open you're able to be, the more you connect on not just a physical level, but also emotional, mental, and spiritual level.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. What we were talking about earlier as far as people who are repressed, I think you put it really well previously when you said that you're disconnected from your sense of self. And if you're disconnected from your sense of self, you're never going to be able to open up in a sexual way.
Mm-hmm.
That's just not going to happen, because you're not going to allow yourself to be that vulnerable and to share and be that open with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's really a not only trust of your partner, but a trust of self.
You were mentioning that, and I was trying to think of an example of somebody that I could think of that does not appear to have any illusions as to who they are. They are very comfortable of what kind of person they are, their identity on all levels, and they're happy with it, and that's just the way it is, and it's just like, that's me. And the only person I could think of was Han Solo from Star Wars.
Oh.
That character, in my opinion, is somebody who, you know, is like, look, this is who I am. A lot of people don't like it, but who cares? That's just what I do. And, you know, I'm just trying to make my way in this crazy universe just like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess another person would be like, oh, Mal from the Firefly series.
I never watched Firefly.
Oh, you are missing out on some really good sci-fi. He's kind of along the same lines of, look, I knew who I am. I have my own belief system, my own philosophies, and it does not go with the status quo, and that's why I got to hide around a little bit and move, not be put down by the man, you know? So, and I think whenever you are repressing a part of who you are, regardless of what you think or what the culture or friends or family thinks, you are giving away part of your power. Mm-hmm. It's like, let's take a completely hopefully safe idea. Let's say you are a huge military person, a stereotypical military mindset. You come from a long line of military families where it's just like, we will go to war and we may not like it, we may not come back, but, you know, a warrior type mindset. And then let's say all of a sudden you're a son of one of a general to the president or whatever, and you are totally not into war or military or anything like that, and you really, really like, you know, white fluffy bunnies. Mm-hmm. So you probably aren't going to be thought of very highly with the rest of your family, because it's like, you're a son, males in our family have a tradition of going into the military, and it's like, you're going to be a veterinarian, like, but you're a male in our family, you're supposed to go into the military. Like, but I like bunnies. I'm going to sell bunnies. They're so cute and soft and fluffy. And it's like, oh, boy. And so repressing that and then going into the military and saying, okay, I don't like white fluffy bunnies anymore, that is totally giving your power away. That is denying a part of who you are. And people do that so often with so many areas of their life that, you know, it blows my mind, where it's like, no wonder we need so much medication and all this healthcare stuff that we have, because people are giving their power away completely, and now we have medications that can make you feel like you still have your power, even when you don't.
But, you know, here's what I'm wondering, though. If we were to open up and to accept who we were sexually and not have so many mores and social mores that were repressive, and we were just kind of more open, because remember the 60s was the old love and openness and all this other stuff, then what's to keep us from just having, you know, want and sex and, you know, just creating all these children all over the place? There are schools of thought that say that's irresponsible, and other schools of thought that say, well, you know what, it's what we are, you know, we're doing what we are as physical creatures, as with the ability to procreate.
So what you're saying is, if we were not sexually repressed as a society and culture, the only thing we'd be interested in is sex?
No. What I'm saying is that if we would not put any limits on our sexuality, and we would just, you know, be open about it, have it with whomever we want and wherever we want, without worrying about the byproduct of it, which is creating a human life.
Mm-hmm.
One of the arguments is if you let people just do whatever and whoever they want, that you're going to have all these babies all over the place with no means of, you know, really raising them or taking care of them or being able to provide for them. That's one of the arguments of it, that there's got to be some restrictions as far as holding back your sexuality to where you're not. I mean, because the only foolproof method of birth control is abstinence.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, that I'm just kind of throwing that out there. That's often what is one of the arguments of being open to your own sexuality, that may be a result of it. And so I'm kind of wondering how you'd respond to that.
Well, let's look at China, where I think you're only supposed to have like one, maybe two, is it one or two children total?
Two children. Unless they changed it.
You know, it's basically like, you're only allowed to have two children, plain and simple. You get pregnant again, I'm sorry, it's like, you can't have that third child.
But in this country, that we consider that an impingement on human rights.
Exactly. But if we got to a level of population where our resources were strained and living conditions got much more compressed than they are now, we might get to a point where we would put laws, limitations on having how many children you can have. So I also have to think that if we did not have any hang-ups or repressions of, and we were completely open with our sexuality, and I believe there would still be a lot of people, I believe a majority of people, that would still be highly responsible.
You know, I would agree with that. In fact, there are cultures, not our culture, not Western culture, there are cultures that are considered primitive, in quotes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
if you put a bone through any, you know, piece of your skin, apparently you're primitive. But they,
but silver doesn't
but
count.
But silver's fine, yeah, exactly. But in these cultures, it has to be pretty. Bones aren't pretty. I'm just.
I got a Pepsi can. Does that count? No.
I know. It needs to be pretty. It needs to be gold or silver. But in these societies, they don't have sexual deviance. It just doesn't exist. Uh-huh. They don't have overpopulation. It doesn't exist. They don't have unwanted pregnancies. These things don't exist. Mm-hmm. So even though the drive is for sexuality is strong, I think it's regulated well. Like, let me use food for an example. Okay. In our society, just eat. Eat whatever you want. If it tastes good, eat it. And if it continues to taste good, eat it. But you need to exercise and don't get fat because we'll hate you. You know, that kind of
thing. Yeah.
But in other cultures, in the animal kingdom is great. I mean, sex is not a fair comparison for them because they're regulated by, you know, their cycles of heat and all that stuff. Mm-hmm.
And the
but
food chain.
Same, mm-hmm. And the food chain. I know. Damn food chain gets in the way. Yeah. But as far as food goes, they don't eat if they're not hungry. Mm-hmm. They just don't. And in these other cultures, you know, the sexual impetus is higher when you can support the population. And it is lower in people when they have that modicum of they know what's good for society and they don't create more children than the population can support, than the food sources can support. Like you said, the food chain, mm-hmm. you know. But in our society, we don't, you know, we're so upside down and backwards on what's right and wrong sexually. And our identity is so screwed up when it comes to our sexuality that we have no self-control. We don't take those things into consideration. It's just really about the feel-good part. And we're of a feel-good society. And I think the great thing about spirituality with sexuality is you understand that it is beyond feeling good.
Oh, yeah.
And I do think that people who participate in a lot of sex exclusively for the feeling good are disconnected from their own spirituality.
They're going for the physical expression to I think a lot of people that have a lot of sex indiscriminately are trying to find that spiritual feeling through sex, mm-hmm. as opposed to others who try to have a sexual feeling through spirit, or that didn't come out right. Let me put it this way. Change the energy from sexual energy to a spiritual energy.
Ah, nice, nice. I like the way you put that. Yeah. I think it's like those people are seeking intimacy but are unable to have it. Or something inside them says, you know what, the path to intimacy is sex.
Mm-hmm.
So they take that path, but they're incapable of allowing, number one, I think they're incapable of acknowledging their sexuality, who they are, and it to be a good thing. And interestingly enough, I think that it's to when you see others that you find attractive as sexual objects and you don't consider them, you know, their personhood.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is also a symptom of that disconnect within the self, that you see sexuality as, you know, these people who sleep indiscriminately with other people. I think that they're kind of missing that sense of, you know, sex being a very natural and intimate associative thing.
Oh, yeah. And what you're talking about with. You see someone on the TV, or you're out around the town, or you're at a bar or whatever. Actually, I'm too old to go to bars now, but to pick people up, or at least I feel like I am. But I never liked the bar scene anyway. But, you know, you see somebody that you find physically attractive, and if you're in that whole mindset, everybody's there to hook up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all based on physical attraction. It's like, okay, if you look half decent and you can put words together without slobbering all over yourself, you're good to go for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Like what you said, really combining, getting to know somebody, to have getting that closeness on all levels, you know, mm-hmm. physical, mental, spiritual and emotional. That's where what you said at the beginning of the podcast, that is where the openness, where the ecstasy, where the thing where they write tons and tons of storylines where they have all these things of like, you know, true love is like this, and oh yeah, the sex is part of it too. Or they have come out from completely the opposite direction where it's like, oh, sex is so wonderful, you can actually reach the heights of, you know, and touch the mind of God or touch the hand of God through sex. And I think a lot of people say, oh, so I have to find somebody I can have really good sex with to have that highly spiritual experience. It's not an either or thing with a physical thing or a spiritual thing. It's a, like what you said, it's a person thing.
Exactly.
It's how much you're able to open up to somebody else. Most people can't really open up to somebody within 5 minutes, mm-hmm. or even 10 minutes. It takes time. It takes getting to know them.
I like what your thread is, and I'm going to kind of ping off of it. What made me think about this is when you said, you know, do you have to have a really intense sexual experience to have a spiritual connection?
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard people say, you know, sex with this person was dynamite, but we just didn't get along otherwise. Well, if you ask me, the sex meaning, you know, the sensation, and I'm saying the purely physical sensation was dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, well, then to me, you really haven't had what I consider true sex, if that's the case. It's more so to me, if you're having really fulfilling and enlightening spiritual sex, it's far beyond the physical sensation.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's when you, like I said, when the borders are broken down between the individuals and you really can't tell one apart from the other, you're so entwined. And the thing is I think anybody who says, well, we didn't get along, you know, it's like, to me, it's a very similar feeling to when you're with a person and just that there's an act of being with them. There's nothing spectacular you're doing. You're mm-hmm. maybe just taking a walk. You may be just talking about something you like, you know, but you're lost in that moment. You're lost in the being with that person.
Oh, yeah.
And then it's just in, then you're taken into another place. You're taken into the bedroom. It's the same idea, but just in the bedroom, just with a physical, you know, sexual connection.
Oh, yeah.
Or the bathroom or, you know, or the hotel roof or whatever you want to call it. But, you know, you choose the location.
So what you're saying is you can have highly spiritual sexual experience even if you're, say, sharing a dinner with somebody.
Well, no, that's not what I was saying. I mean, what I was saying is I find it unlikely that a person would have a highly spiritual sexual experience with someone that they did not get along with. The people who say we had great sex, but we didn't, but we fought all the time outside of the bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I'm like, well, if you consider great sex just intense orgasms, then that's not great sex.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's it's sex. It's physical. It's, you know,
mechanical.
You know, right. Yeah, it's not, you know, it's mechanical, exactly, you know, and basically it's the checkered flag again.
Push a button, put in your quarter, push a button, ready to go.
Exactly, it's putting in a quarter, pushing the buttons. And so that's what I'm saying is that I think you have to have just an intense love and respect for the other person. It doesn't have to be somebody you're married to necessarily. It has to be someone that you truly love on a spiritual level. Mm-hmm. And there's so many degrees of love, but if you could take that, you know, into a sexual experience and be it out of the sexual experience, I think they have to coexist at the same time.
So now I have a question for you. Is it possible to be in a relationship with somebody where you have an amazingly sexual, physical experience where one partner is highly spiritual and one partner is not?
Well, it depends on what you mean by highly spiritual.
One person is working specifically and consciously on their self-growth and their spirituality, where the other person is just like, that's a whole bunch of hoopley-goopley, whatever. I'm more interested in working on other stuff. In other words, they don't appear to express their spiritual side of themselves at all, if ever.
Well, see, but I think that's very, very subjective, because for me, expressing my spiritual self is really delving into what we delve into in the podcast and really doing self-reflection and really kind of looking at how I'm creating my own world. There are other people who are very much into fitness and exercise and doing races and those kind of things. You know, they're just on the go people. They're at the gym, they're constantly working out, or they're improving their body. And, you know, they're into sports and all that other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But who am I to say that that's not spirituality for them?
Mm.
You see what I'm saying? Who am I to say that that's not their path to spiritual growth?
Okay, so I guess it is kind of late in the episode to mention this, but what exactly are we talking about when we say spirituality? How can we define what is spirituality?
Oh, you mean for the sake of spiritual sexuality?
Just in general, because the whole topic is sexuality and spirituality combined.
Mm-hmm.
We defined quite well exactly what is sexuality, all the various flavors and ways that it can be expressed and all the stuff. But did we ever actually define what is spirituality?
I would say spirituality is your connection to that which lets you know that you are, exist, that you are alive, and on a very profound level.
I pinch myself. Oop, I guess I'm alive. Is that spirituality?
If you consider that profound.
I don't know if I can really consider that profound. Well, how... see, now, and I'm gonna all caught up in this whole, what is spirituality? How can you define spirituality?
Well, that's the thing, is I don't think it's easy to define, you know. And I have to do it from the confines of my own definition, and that's about my limits of it. For me, my spirituality is my connection to, my understanding, my connection to basically what I am and the source of what I am, mm-hmm. and what I am creating. My spirituality I'm most connected to in the moments that I can't describe, the moments where there are no words for it. That's the moment I really feel the most connected to my spirituality.
Like, okay, I'm curious, what are you talking about, like moments or like aha moments or what?
Moments of just pure reverie, moments of, okay, it could be something so simple as I'm walking down the street and I'm just looking at the trees and I'm just marvel at just the beauty of nature, the intricacy of nature, or where I'm just sitting in a quiet moment and I'm just thinking, it's wonderful to be alive. Or, you know, during times of sex where this is just like, there's an experience so incredible. That's what I'm talking about. The experience of being alive that is just so incredible that you just, you feel like you could hold on to that moment forever, but that moment always slips away from you.
So when you're in those moments and you're aware that you're in those moments, you've shifted out of the moment and become part of yourself observing yourself in the moment. Mm-hmm. Would that be what you'd consider a sign of having a spiritual experience, is being able to observe yourself in one of those moments?
I think I can only observe myself in that moment when I'm out of the moment, ironically, paradoxically.
So therefore, is being in the moment a spiritual thing or just a thing?
I think being in the moment is the ultimate in being spiritual.
But how can you be in the moment if you don't realize if you're always observing yourself being in the moment and shifting back and forth?
That's the paradox. It is a paradox, and I think you can't get away from it. You have to accept that there's a paradox to it. You know, here's the way I look at it. It's like, to take a tangent from what we're talking about, I was driving to work today, and I was just trying to think of why it is that so many, we cannot see that we are interconnected. We cannot feel it. Mm-hmm. We're so caught up with our own boundary of the ego and the self and being defined as the self. And to me, it's like, we would get it as if we were like our eyes. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed that if you're looking at an object, you can't tell which eye is looking at that object, right?
Mm-hmm.
Until you close one.
Oh, yeah.
And you only know because it's closed. But when both of your eyes are open and both your eyes are focused on something, you don't say, well, it's my left eye that's focused on that, or my right. It's both of them, right?
Yeah.
But unfortunately, we as human beings don't function the way our eyes do. But if we did, if we understood that this experience is really a shared experience. Let me give you an example.
Okay.
When I'm talking to somebody, just the act of talking to somebody makes them part of my experience and me part of theirs, mm-hmm. to where we think that it's our own experience, but they themselves are a part of who I am because they're part of my experience, you know, and vice versa with them. So in that regard, everything everybody does is a piece of who we are. Everything we experience is a piece of who we are, which means that everybody else's experience, as we come across it in one way or another, is part of our own experience. Oh. So it seems contradictory, but it is. And I think that the moment, being in the moment and coming back out of the moment, it's like when we talked about, and this ties very much into this topic, when you and I were talking about creation,
uh-huh.
the nonlinear creation.
Oh, yeah.
Remember we talked about going all the way to the Big Bang and just at the collapse is when the creation happens?
Oh, yeah.
You see what I'm saying? And I think that explosive energy that occurs during sex is another analogy and a symbolism of what happens when you are in that moment and when that moment passes. once you observe that moment, you're no longer in that moment. But when you're in that moment, you can't observe it because you're so in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sexuality probably makes us so much more aware of that than so many other things.
Well, yeah, because for a lot of people, the whole going through the whole climax with a rush of all those chemicals that are going on through your body that your brain is putting out, it's really difficult to think about what you need to get at the grocery store when you're at that moment.
Right.
Up to that point and shortly thereafter, oh yeah, not a problem. But for that little time right there where you're having that complete ecstasy, I don't think it's possible to really be anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of like you're not really thinking or seeing. You're literally just being. And then of course you can remember afterwards and have memory of, oh, was I really that silly at that point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And now, would you consider that a spiritual experience?
Yeah. And I would, because my definition of spirituality is anything that brings you a sense of feeling that is above just basic mundane stuff. Like, you can watch a movie and have a spiritual experience. If it moves you in some way, I'll use your word, in a profound way,
mm-hmm.
you know, or even in a significant way, then I believe it's a spiritual experience. And you don't have to necessarily be moved profoundly or significantly to, quote unquote, be spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where I'm getting lost now. I think I'm going to go back.
No, I think you're right. I mean, to me, you don't have to have it. You're right. I agree with you 100%. You do not have to have a profound experience. I mean, I said that, and I'm going to pull back on what I said a little bit. But I'm going to rephrase it to say that if you could find beauty in a specific moment, that's spiritual.
You know what? I like that really good.
I like it better. I'm rescinding my first one and throwing that one out there. I'm replacing it. Do I get to do that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we can do that. You know.
That's right. We can do that.
We are all powerful.
That's right.
We totally know who we are and what we can do. So, but I really like that. I want you to say it one more time because I just like the way that you put it.
I'd say that spirituality, moments of spirituality, is when you can find beauty in any given moment.
Ah.
And I say that because I really had to be careful, because there are very mundane things in life, lots of mundane things in life, and yet you can find spirituality in those mundane things.
Oh, yeah.
There are painful things in life. There are things that are highly unpleasant, but there are spiritual, you can find the beauty in the mundane, and you can find the beauty in the unpleasant.
I love that definition of spirituality because it's short, it's sweet. To me, I'm like, why didn't I think of this? This is so perfect. It's so simple. It's just,
hey,
like,
I didn't think of it without you sitting here talking to me. So take credit. Take credit for it.
I take no credit. It's all you, David.
I can share.
Okay, well, if you want to share, go ahead and share.
You could throw it on your live your life fantastic page and then give yourself credit for it.
No, I couldn't do that because then people would listen to this episode and be like, why is he taking credit for David's?
What's this guy doing here?
Yeah, exactly. So I think the whole idea of sexuality and spirituality in our culture, I think it would be much more powerful to start seeing them as combined and start learning and understanding how they work in conjunction with one another, instead of seeing them as separate. And it's like, well, if you're highly sexual, you're not necessarily highly spiritual, or if you're highly spiritual, why do you need to be sexual? And mm-hmm. I think combining those ideas of, well, your spiritual is powerful and your sexuality is powerful, if you combine them and you work those parts of yourself into your expression of who you are to the world, mm-hmm. I think you become a much, much more empowered person.
Absolutely. Understanding that our sexuality is who we are, mm-hmm. that it is our gift as physical beings, and not to take that gift and to turn it into something debased.
I agree wholeheartedly. So for Take the Red Pill and DonDalton.com, I am Donald Dalton, wishing you a life fantastic.
And I am David Deere. If it feels good and you don't hurt anybody, unless they ask you to, go for it.